The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I had the pleasure recently of attending the first annual New Jersey Harm Reduction Conference. On today's show, we're going to hear from one of the speakers, Dr. Sheila Vakaria with the Drug Policy Alliance. But first, ChangeLab Solutions is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that uses the tools of law and policy to advance health equity. They recently published a couple of very useful resources, one entitled Preventing Overdose and Reducing Drug-Related Harm, a Policy Guide for State and Local Change, and the other, Implementing State and Local Overdose Prevention Policies, a Resource for Navigating the Policy Process. Liz Olson, Senior Policy Analyst at ChangeLab Solutions, discussed these new publications recently at an event sponsored by the Network for Public Health Law. Let's give a listen.
My name is Liz Olson, and I am a Senior Policy Analyst with ChangeLab Solutions. For those who may not know us, ChangeLab is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that uses the tools of law and policy to advance health equity. We partner with communities across the nation to improve health and opportunity by changing harmful laws, policies, and systems. Our interdisciplinary team works with community organizations, governments, and local institutions to design and implement equitable and practical policy solutions to complex health challenges. So today, we are excited to introduce two new resources that we've developed with support from the CDC and in partnership with the Network for Public Health Law. They highlight state and local policy strategies to reduce overdose and other drug-related harms. So the policy guide pictured on the left of this slide highlights a range of state and local policy strategies, outlining the details of potential options for new policy or changes to existing policy to help mitigate the overdose crisis. And the implementation resource pictured on the right offers guidance on the policy process, supporting readers to put those strategies into practice on the ground. So the policy guide is sort of the what, and the implementation resource is intended to help folks think through the how. They're both now available on the ChangeLab Solutions website, and I will drop that link in the chat in a moment. So in addition to these, another resource was developed by our partners at the National Association of Counties, NACO, for this project. It highlights five counties using opioid settlement funds to advance health equity, detailing the steps that they've taken in the early years of payments and highlighting some considerations for other localities. That resource is available on NACO's Opioid Solutions Center website, which offers many other valuable resources to support local leaders in their prevention and crisis response work. So I'll share that link in the chat as well in a moment. So just to share some context for how the policy guide and implementation resource were developed, I'll share that our team used a couple of different methods to identify the strategies that we outline in the documents, including an initial scan of peer-reviewed and gray literature to identify existing overdose prevention policies implemented in four focus sectors, which are healthcare, criminal legal, schools, and community. Interviews with 22 experts across those sectors who work in a variety of state and local contexts across the nation, including as researchers, healthcare providers, policymakers, community-based organization and government agency staff, policy experts and advocates. Many also shared their perspectives as people with lived experience. And we're extremely grateful to each of them for sharing their expertise with us. Their insights are really foundational to these materials, and you'll hear some of their quotes today in Amy's presentation. We also conducted an assessment to screen policies across a range of impact and feasibility criteria, like strength of evidence, ability to advance equity, which helped us to produce kind of the final group of strategies that are highlighted in the guide. So the policy guide introduces each strategy, briefly reviews relevant evidence and considerations for how the policy can be designed to reach people facing elevated risk, and highlights an example in action at the state or local level. And the implementation resource on the next slide is intended for readers who may be less familiar with the policymaking process. It outlines key steps to put policies into practice, sharing guidance for identifying needed interventions, advancing them through the adoption process, and implementing them so they create meaningful change in people's lives.
That was Liz Olson, Senior Policy Analyst at ChangeLab Solutions, discussing two of ChangeLab's new publications, one entitled Preventing Overdose and Reducing Drug-Related Harm, A Policy Guide for State and Local Change, and the other, Implementing State and Local Overdose Prevention Policies, A Resource for Navigating the Policy Process. To learn more, find ChangeLab Solutions on the web at changelabsolutions.org. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I had the pleasure recently of attending the first annual New Jersey Harm Reduction Conference. And before I go on, I just want to say how grateful I am that organizations are continuing to embrace modern technology and live streaming events like this. I get to attend a really interesting, really useful event thousands of miles away from my home with no muss, no fuss, no inconvenience, no wasting limited resources on travel, food, and accommodations. You know, in the last couple of weeks alone, I've attended events in New Jersey, New York, Canada, Switzerland, Australia, and other locations in the U.S. and around the world, all without having to leave home. More to the point, organizations and individuals are able to share their knowledge, answering questions, and engaging in conversations with more than just the folks who have the time and resources to be physically in some conference venue or hotel somewhere, but rather directly in real time with people around the planet. Live streaming is intelligent use of technology that allows me to bring you highlights from conferences and seminars taking place around the world without breaking the bank or generating a carbon footprint the size of a charcoal Sasquatch. But I digress. One of the keynote speakers at the New Jersey Harm Reduction Conference was Dr. Sheila Vakaria. Sheila Vakaria, Ph.D., MSW, is the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance, an internationally recognized expert on harm reduction and drug policy. Sheila is also the author of a fine book entitled The Harm Reduction Gap. Here's Dr. Vakaria.
So my presentation is going to be a summary of lessons I've learned about harm reduction practice and policy from my own direct experience, but from listening and learning from the people that I served when I worked in harm reduction and treatment settings, but also from listening to harm reduction providers and other experts in the space. And I'm going to use photos of the movement, the harm reduction movement, in this presentation, because that's what we are. We are a community of care. We are a community of support. And those of us who do this work are doing this work because it saved our lives. So thanks to the National Harm Reduction Coalition, because I'm going to be using photos of our community from their photo project. So what is harm reduction? Here we have Haven Wheelock, who is from Outside in Portland, Oregon, and she writes, "When you walk alone and in the shadows, it is easy to feel lost. Access to harm reduction brings humans into the light and community. It empowers health, hope, and humanity." And if you want a more academic definition, I often look to Alan Marlett, who many of us call the godfather of harm reduction therapy. And in his co-authored book, he and his colleagues write, "Harm reduction is a set of compassionate and pragmatic approaches for reducing harm associated with high-risk behaviors and improving quality of life." So let's talk about harm reduction and where it started. Many of you might be familiar with harm reduction as a public health approach. So you might associate it with public health professionals, medical professionals, and other service providers. But harm reduction's roots are actually in the communities of people who use drugs themselves. In the 80s, people who injected drugs started getting sick, not only here in the United States, but in Europe and around the world. And it was because syringes and the tools used to inject drugs had become criminalized in most parts of the world after we criminalized the drugs first. And in restricting supplies of syringes for people who injected drugs or used them for non-medical purposes, what happened was people who injected drugs at that time and to this day and in our communities, and it's happening right now, were sharing needles with one another, reusing needles amongst themselves, and often transmitting bloodborne infections and developing other kinds of bacterial infections. And so people who injected drugs in the Netherlands formed a drug user union because they noticed that we are getting sick. And no one's doing anything to save us or help us. And we think it might be because we're being forced to use our syringes. And so they said to themselves, if no one else is going to save our lives, we're going to save our own lives. And so they found a way to procure hundreds of thousands of syringes. And amongst themselves, in just a matter of several years, started exchanging
used syringes for new sterile syringes, and within just a matter of 4 years, exchanged nearly 750,000 syringes amongst themselves. People who use drugs, people who are actively using drugs, people who are injecting drugs, saying we are going to save our own lives. And when we have the tools and support to engage in safer use practices, we will, because we've always taken care of ourselves and one another. And so here we are decades later, and through the word of mouth, through policy change, through the expansion of these very foundational principles, harm reduction has not only encapsulates syringe service programs and syringe exchange, it now includes safer smoking equipment, naloxone distribution, overdose prevention centers, and so many other policies and practices. And so harm reduction is more than just its interventions and tools. It's also a philosophy. It's also a series of other approaches as well. And so let's talk about some harm reduction tenets and principles. First and foremost, harm reductionists believe that drugs are here to stay. All societies have used mood-altering substances since the beginning of time. There are receptor sites in our brains that are activated by endogenous neurotransmitters that actually activate those centers in our brain that lead to pleasure, that lead to stimulation, that lead to awakeness, that help us sleep, that help manage our pain. And there are chemicals in our natural environment, often in plants that we all grew up alongside, our ancestors, our foreparents, that we consumed in various socially sanctioned and often recognized ways, whether for spiritual or religious or cultural practices, but often with norms built around how to stay safe. And we have to remember that how we define drug, what we define as a substance, as a mood-altering substance, has never been a fixed category. It's one that's been subjected to social and cultural shifts. It's often been embedded into our policies, but even those have changed over time. And so harm reductionists do not get too caught up in what someone may call a drug, a good drug, a bad drug. That's a drug, that's not a drug, that's legal, that's safe, that's not safe, that's harmful. We don't get into those kinds of conversations because we acknowledge that people use mood-altering substances, and we say, if we accept that reality, how do we keep people safe? And so the aim of a drug-free world is impossible because, again, our definition and our moving target of what a drug is often changes, and it actually belies the fact that we should be having broader conversations about health and safety. And harm reductionists would argue that drug use is not a moral issue. It says nothing of your character or personality or value or inherent worth about which neurochemicals are activated in your brain. Your worth is more than that. And we don't believe that people who, for putting substances into their body, should be criminalized for making those choices. Fundamentally, I also want to acknowledge that harm reductionists see drug use as occurring on a continuum, from abstinence to regular, more frequent use, including some forms of problematic or harmful use. And I think this is really important because we live in a very black and white world where either you're using or you're not. Either you get high or you're sober or clean. And unfortunately, when we have those kinds of conversations, it kind of blurs over the nuance that's really important if we want to talk about keeping people safe. Because the frequency of use, the regularity of use, the quantity of use, and the consequences you experience because of your use are conversations that you can only have if you dig deeper than simply, do you have a chemical in your body or not? And I think it also acknowledges that not all use is problematic. And I think that's really important for us to acknowledge. The vast majority of us who use mood-altering substances do not experience harmful or negative consequences with them. And so again, harm reductionists, in acknowledging that that drug use occurs on a continuum, are then able to invite people all along the continuum to have conversations about their relationship with substances. And it kind of also challenges this idea that any use is abuse, that any use is problematic, that any use is going to wreck your life. Again, there is no inevitability with drug use, although many people in traditional spaces talk about this inevitable path towards criminality, death, and disease with drug use. The reality is the majority of us go on to use substances, live whole and fulfilling and healthy lives, and we can't just falsely equivocate between use and harmful use. I think the other really important thing that harm reductionists are willing to have conversations about is the fact that your use patterns and your relationship with one drug may be different from your relationship with another drug. In so many traditional settings, which serve people who use drugs, but also serve broader communities, whether they acknowledge or not these people are using drugs, is this idea that if you have a challenging or problematic relationship with one drug, that by default, you are engaging in problematic and risky drug use with all of the drugs in your life. And the reality is, most of us choose the drugs we use for their effects because we like something about them. Most of us have preferences about the drugs that we dislike and like, or the ones that we want to use more regularly, or the ones we want to use less frequently. And I think it's really important as harm reductionists that we invite these kinds of nuanced and complicated conversations. Don't assume because I have a challenging relationship with fentanyl that I can't go and drop a tab of acid if I'm at a festival or at a party, right? If I can't control my alcohol consumption and that's really causing some problems in my life, it doesn't mean I can't smoke a joint every once in a while. And being able to have those kinds of open conversations to invite people to tell you about their unique relationships with substances is a really important starting point that only harm reductionists can engage in, because our traditional settings do not create the space for people to have those kinds of conversations. I think the other thing that's really important for us to also acknowledge is that harm is relative. I joke all the time that I'm kind of a normie. Look at me up here, kind of respectable, got a couple degrees, written a book, whatever, right? And I come in this kind of package. And what harm looks like to me when it comes to my substance use involves hangovers that affect my ability to do my work the next day, maybe spending a little bit more on a night than I'd like to, those kinds of things that affect me that make me reevaluate what are my patterns of use. And so to me, someone who's on the street smoking meth, not in a shelter, walking the streets, that may seem like, well, that's a pretty harmful choice that you're making there. And yes, like you've been doing it for a couple nights in a row and you're hearing things and you're getting paranoid and you haven't eaten and you haven't drank water. To me, looking at that looks like a harm. And I might want to say to you, as the normie person that I am, you might have a problem. That seems like harmful meth use. But to them, the fact that there's no beds at the shelter, they got kicked out of the detox. The fact that actually meth use that night is how they're staying alive tonight. It's the reason why they're not going to get raped. It's the reason why they're not going to get robbed. And they can sleep on a corner in peace in the daytime. And at least no one's going to mess with them. So again, understanding as a harm reductionist that harm is relative. And my definitions of harm in my normie, comfortable, privileged life may make it hard for me to see that for people who are dealing with multiple structural challenges, their relative harms are systemic and structural. And actually, their drug use sometimes is a way to manage that harm. Right? And I think it's also really important that as harm reductionists, we acknowledge that drugs can be dangerous. I'm a harm reductionist. Harm is part of my name. But if I don't talk about benefits and practicalities and levels of use and frequency of use and what's this serving for you, I can't have a conversation about harm, because all of our traditional settings start with the danger, start with the risk, and don't really engage with you in the nuance of your life. And so again, when you have conversations about drug use occurring on a continuum, what feels dangerous and risky to you? What do you feel like you've got under control? Can I offer you some tools and strategies to help you stay safe? So, Eddie, I'm going to need your zoom in help for a second. So I've got an image here from David Nutt and colleagues' seminal paper in 2010, where they really like dug deep into the key drugs of use at that time. Fentanyl was not part of our broader constellation of drugs, but they did really useful risk analysis and evaluation of drug-related harm. And I find this table to be incredibly helpful. In again, as harm reductionists, we want to talk about harms of use, but we want to be clear, we want to be precise. And so what I like about how they talk about harms is, first and foremost, this idea of overall harm, right? And then we talk about, if we're going to talk about drug-related harms, let's talk about the drug-related harms that users face, and then the ones that are faced by broader society. So right now we're zoomed into the top part to talk about users. And so when we talk about the harms that are experienced by users themselves, they fall into three major categories, right? Physical harms, psychological harms, and the social harms, okay? And again, when we dig deep in these granular levels, we can actually then find the areas where we want to intervene and help people safe. Again, harm reductionists do not overlook or gloss over drug-related harms. We just like getting specific. Right? We like getting specific and then tailoring our approaches. So when we talk about physical drug-related harms, we're talking about drug-related mortality or morbidity, right? So the chronic long-term use of a stimulant wearing down my cardiovascular system, right? Affecting my heart health. We can talk about the use of a strong depressant like an opioid, and that leading to a potential fatal overdose. We can talk about the damage that may occur from long-term injection drug use, right? And so, like, what do we talk about when we talk about like vein health and all those kinds of things? Right. We also then can then talk about the psychological harms. Like, what are those psychological harms? We can talk about the way it affects our decision making and response time when we're behind the wheel. We can talk about how it actually triggers our underlying depression or mental illness. We can talk how it exacerbates or makes worse some of the symptoms that we have. We can talk about substance use disorders. And then when we talk about the social harms that people who use drugs might face, you know, the loss of tangibles, perhaps my relationship with alcohol made it so that I eventually lost that job. And when I lost that job, I couldn't make my car payments. And when I couldn't make my car payments, I couldn't keep up with my childcare responsibilities. And maybe I lost custody of my kids, right? So losing those tangibles and intangibles. Again, if we don't pinpoint those drug-related harms, we then can't identify points of intervention, whether it's at a micro individual level, working with someone directly, programmatic policies that we can pass to intervene and help people, or broader macro policies where we can help people stay safe. Now, if we can shift down now to the harms experienced by others, beautiful. Again, we can talk about the harms in terms of the things we say and do to others, the actual injury harm that we may have, but then these broader social harms, right? The fact that the United States' insatiable demand for drugs is wreaking havoc on Latin America. That our insatiable desire for drugs has created drug economies that are not regulated, that are often exploitative, that extract from communities, that damage their environments, that really harm people, and that put them in harm's way because we've moved these forms of drugs and products out of the licit market, out of regulatory protections, out of worker protections, out of any sort of conflict resolution opportunities, out of any sort of tax extraction from them. And instead, they're the Wild West, right? And we are destabilizing entire governments with our insatiable demand for drugs. We can talk about the economic costs of lost productivity, lost all these kinds of other issues. We can talk about the environmental costs of synthesizing and growing plants in the rainforest, in preserves and other kinds of natural environments. So we are actually damaging our environment with these unregulated drug markets, right? So you can zoom back out now. So again, as harm reductionists, we want to say there are many potential areas we can help when we have frank conversations about drug-related harms. And the question always is, how do we help people move towards safety? Right? How do we work towards public safety? How do we work towards community safety? How do we work towards individual and family safety? But that also, most importantly, even non-dependent users could potentially face some of these risks. And unfortunately, our systems of care are only targeted for people who meet diagnostic criteria for a substance use disorder, right? Because even the occasional cocaine user should probably know about naloxone. Even the occasional marijuana smoker should get some information about how long they're going to be impaired before they should get behind a wheel of a car. Even the boomer generation, which is now drinking alcohol at rates that have left all other elderly populations in the wind, should learn about how their livers aren't the same livers that they had in their 20s and mixed up with their medications. We need to make some different choices. All right. So we need to have conversations about these kinds of things. I think what's also really important, and I'm sorry, I don't talk in 45-minute increments, so this is really challenging for me. I talk in like 90-minute increments. It's a problem. Okay, so first and foremost, harm reductionists also believe that instead of talking about people having addictions to drugs, we like talking about people having relationships with drugs. Because we believe and that people use drugs for reasons and that like your substance use isn't just some spontaneous thing you did. Some of us do use compulsively in certain situations, but oftentimes we are using substances for a very clear reason. And it has significance to us. It may be part of our ritual. It may be part of how we grieve. It may be how we celebrate. It may be how we deal with boredom. It may be the only way we know how to socialize. People use drugs for reasons. And it's really important, again, when talking about harm reduction, before jumping ahead to maybe you shouldn't be doing that anymore, tell me about what it is about your use of substance X, where it serves a function for you, where it serves a purpose for you, and what role it plays in your life. And let me say that those reasons are all valid. And again, maybe me as a normie, I am mortified by that reason. I am mortified by that pattern of drug use, but it's not about me, right? And so I think it's really important for us to acknowledge that for many people, their drug use saved their lives. Drugs sometimes are the things that saved people's lives, that got them through unbelievable circumstances, that numbed them out so they could survive, that dissociated them enough so that they could keep it together. And we have to acknowledge that for many people, drug use is still on some extent a functional practice. And again, if we use our normative, our ideas of values to judge someone else's reasons for use, we've already lost, right? And we have to acknowledge for many people, although yes, I believe that, you know, psychiatric medications have a role to play, even as your commissioner said, methadone has a better track record than psych meds. And the average person has to wait 6 to 12 weeks per medication cycle to even figure out, is this thing working for me? And then the detox off of that med before starting a new psych med can be challenging. But if I know that heroin gives me 95% symptom reduction, and I don't want to play that game with my psych meds right now, and I also don't have a psychiatrist who's willing to treat me, we have to acknowledge that drug use has meaning, right? And again, that people do a cost-benefit analysis when they decide to take a substance. Do I want to do this right now? And if I do this, what's that going to mean for me later? And the math is that changing how I feel now trumps the consequences I may need to deal with later. And so meeting people where they're at, so that understanding like what's going through your head in that moment where you need to use right now, and saying that that is a valid reason. I might not have been that person. I might not have made that choice, but it's really important for me to not make you feel irrational, to not make you feel unreasonable, to not make you feel like you are making a horrible decision for yourself, when actually you have valid reasons that I cannot understand. And I think fundamentally, if you take nothing else away from my presentation, this sentence I think is the most important one. So often our systems of care are built around first and foremost pathologizing someone's relationship with drugs and saying, you have a problem, you need to stop, and you need to stop now. And often what we do is we take away the one coping strategy that's getting them through. And we take away their coping strategies and we leave them raw and vulnerable to life's challenges. And we do not give them the tools to cope adequately, and then they're set up to fail, right? Because failure is returning to use, their one coping strategy. And so what I think is so incredible about harm reduction is we don't take away what we can't replace, because we don't know what we're taking away yet. And so we work with people to understand why you're using, what role is this playing in your life? And then let's talk about, are there other tools and strategies, techniques, also policies and programs that you need, that if they aren't met first, your drug use is not going to change. And so like, I need to talk about what safety looks like with you. We're so quick to want to just jump to stop using drugs. We forget that we are taking away a coping strategy before we give any supports in place first.
That was Dr. Sheila Vakharia, Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance and author of The Harm Reduction Gap, speaking at the first annual New Jersey Harm Reduction Conference. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for community radio and syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's Audio Port service. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.